Hi, Mickey.
Hey, Bob.
How you doing?
Pretty good. You'll see there have been some changes around here.
Oh, yeah?
I got new bookcases.
Ooh. Wood? Are they fake wood?
No, they're metal.
Where'd you get them? IKEA?
Fake wood raises the danger of formaldehyde. You know that, Bob.
I do now.
So we avoid formaldehyde.
Where'd you get them?
Where did I get them? I got them Crate and Barrel 2.
Hmm.
It's like for people who don't have enough money to afford Crate and Barrel
1.
Crate and Barrel 1, yeah, but they're actually pretty well made, so.
Well, good.
I'm for them.
Well, good. There's been a little criticism of your backdrop, as you know.
Well, the New York Times said they were going to fall over, but they're not.
So it's been 2 weeks since we did this. I saw your dialogue with Josh Marshall, my substitute.
Yeah.
It was good to see that I'm not the only person who's put in a bad mood by you. You seem to annoy him fairly thoroughly.
Really? I thought he was in a relatively good mood. There were all sorts of people running around his house or his office or wherever.
Yeah, I've been there. It's one of these open office environments. There's like three or four people working there.
I hate that. I think that's been like one of the. In addition to terrorism and world impoverishment, the open office movement has been one of the worst things to happen.
That's my big three. I always list them in that order, yeah.
Okay, well, anyway.
But it was good.
I thought he was fine. No, he was fine.
I'm just saying that like me, he seems to find you a little annoying sometimes.
No, but I thought he had the air of, God, I'm dealing with a wild man here. I better be calm.
Well, that's the difference, you see. I let you get under my skin, whereas he just kind of, like, brushes you off his skin as if you were a little bug or something. And that kind of attitude of high-minded disdain is one that I hope to cultivate. That's what I'm going to try.
I thought I was a bigger than a little bug. Anyway.
Like a medium-sized bug. He had to exert a little energy. A little.
Okay, well, we'll try your disdain. Condescension is always a devastating strategy.
But that was good. And then I had a dialogue with Ann Althaus. She was good.
The part I saw, I thought she was quite good.
She was good. She was very civil. I mean, I think maybe she has a latent combative side that could be brought out by a sufficiently provocative interlocutor.
Or maybe that'll come out over time.
I'm hoping that we can provoke an ill-advised outburst at some point when she's on the show, yeah.
But she's blonde.
Blonde?
Yes.
True.
So we had our first.
That's the kind of thing you would not know by just reading her blog, because the picture of her on her blog is like Andy Warholized.
I think the picture shows she's blonde.
Oh, okay. I take that part back.
But anyway.
You know, one more thing in the blogosphere front. Did you know that President of Iran Ahmadinejad has a blog now?
No, I didn't.
Ahmadinejad.ir. That was in the news today. And. The first sentence, aside from a couple of religious ritualistic utterances, are the first sentence is, during the era that nobility was a prestige and living in a city was perfection, I was born in a poor family in a remote village of Garmsar. Another sentence is, since the extinct Shah was supposed to take and enter Iran into Western civilization slavishly, so many schemes were implemented that Iran becomes another market for the Western ceremonial goods without any progress in the scientific field. You know, you assume that he's got, like, one of the best translators floating around that country, right?
Well, what I say when people don't understand my blog is you got to follow the links. So maybe if you follow the links, it'll make sense.
I don't think that would do it here. I'm starting to think that this regime is just not a very high-quality operation, Mickey. Not yours, I mean his. Yours is.
If they can't produce a good blog, how are they going to produce nuclear weapons?
Wait, beg your pardon, what did you say?
If they can't produce a good blog, how are they going to produce nuclear weapons?
I hadn't thought of that. But, yeah, it's a good question. Why worry about these guys? No, actually, I kind of worry all the more that clear communication is a good crisis avoidance technique, and I'm kind of wondering whether it's possible with this guy. So, anyway, what are we going to talk about?
I guess the first thing we have to talk about is the ceasefire in Lebanon. You know, my area of expertise is the Middle East, as you know. One of the big questions is, has Israel accomplished anything? And I can't, my impression is that, you know, if they are at the Litani River, they have accomplished something.
If their troops are at the Litani River?
Yeah, I mean, the reports a couple days ago were that they were bogged down within a mile of the border. Well, if they're not bogged down within a mile of the border anyway, then they have at least a shot at making their northern border safer.
Well, yeah, but they were supposed to. I mean, the idea was that they would be there and that they would clear out all of Hezbollah and Hezbollah's infrastructure in between their border and the Litani River. Whether that winds up being done is an interesting question.
Nobody seems to really think it will be.
I mean, first of all, before we get into that, we should get into that, because it may get done. I'm not sure that... I'm quite sure I would still say it did not work out from Israel's point of view. If that's the only other thing that gets accomplished, in other words, clearing out that margin between their border and the Litani River, which is almost the best-case scenario at this point, I would say. I would still say it hasn't been in Israel's interest.
Why? Because it's going to bring Netanyahu to power?
Well, yeah, that's one problem. That's a whole other thing. No, just in terms of the ratcheting up, if such a thing seemed possible, the amount of hatred for Israel and to some extent the United States in the area. I mean, the question is, what will have been accomplished? Before the crisis, Hezbollah had the capacity to terrorize and torment Israel to some extent with these rockets, but not to actually take any land from Israel. I maintain that even if the area up to the Litani River is cleared out, it may be the case that Hezbollah continues to have that capability. I mean, I think some of those... I mean, the rockets they were using can reach some of Israel even from beyond the Litani. And then supposedly they have these 200 other rockets that are much longer range, so that even from beyond the Litani, Haifa will still be in danger. So, I mean... I'm not sure a lot will have been accomplished.
Because here was my theory, okay?
Mm-hmm.
My grand theory of the Middle East from somebody who doesn't know very much about it. One of the standard outcomes of this war is supposedly that it's killed the policy of unilateralism, the idea that Israel can retreat behind walls and fences has been, rendered obsolete by these missiles which go over the walls of fences and hit Israel, so that they can't, that strategy won't work.
That's the consensus in Israel apparently now, yeah.
And it was echoed by various Israelis on the pages of the New York Times today. So what's the next strategy? The next strategy is to go after the great powers that are supposedly behind these local insurgents, and that points to Iran. And clearly what Israel would get out of this under this theory is it would degrade the Hezbollah threat so much that when it goes after Iran's nuclear weapons, Iran doesn't have the power to retaliate. We talked about that before.
Yeah, that's been your theory. I mean,
the more you think about it, the more all the blazing arrows point in that direction, huh?
It's not inconceivable that that's what they're up to, but A, there is domestic political pressure alone is enough to account for why Olmert went this route. Okay, it's not like you need that kind of subtler, cleverer level of explanation.
Well, no, because as I went back and checked this, and I think it's true. Hezbollah, they staged this raid across the border, where they attacked the city and then they captured some that was a diversion, and they had captured some soldiers down the road. They hadn't really launched missiles at population centers.
Right.
So, as you say, Olmert had the choice of ignoring this provocation or making a big deal of it and attempting to roll up Hezbollah.
Right.
He chose the latter. But I don't see why there was huge popular pressure on him to do that until the missiles started raining down, which they didn't do until later.
You may be right. You may be right. I mean, on the other hand, by his, excessive response to the Gaza provocation, bombing the power plant and so on, he had kind of raised the stakes. I mean, if abducting a soldier or two and killing a soldier or two warrants that, well, then what is killing eight soldiers and abducting some...
Well, but he doesn't have to be principled or consistent. He's supposed to be prudent.
No,
he's a leader.
There may have been something else, but again, I'm still not sure that the plan wasn't just... I mean, they thought they could clear Hezbollah out in a few days. And if you can do that, from their point of view, it seems like a tempting thing. So I'm not... I mean, maybe you're right. But in any event, as for whether this was some sort of preparation for a strike against Iran, I don't think it's really worked in a very full-bore way, because I suspect at the end of this, Hezbollah is still going to have the capacity to rain terror on Israel for months. Not as many months. You know, before this, Hezbollah could do it for 10 or 12 months. Now they could probably do it at this rate again for a few months. But kind of what's the difference? I mean, as a tactical matter, I don't think Israel has, you know, a lot depends on what happens now. But I guess what bothers me is I don't see signs that Bush is inclined to try to make kind of the ultimate lemonade out of this lemon and bring Syria into talks and kind of solve the problem on Israel's northern border once and for all, and arrange a big deal where Syria gets the Golan Heights, they quit supplying weapons to Hezbollah, Lebanon gets Sheba Farms, you know, and that would improve Israel's strategic situation.
Can Syria shut down Hezbollah?
Well, apparently it's very hard for Iran to get arms to Hezbollah without going through Syria. So they can, you know, make life much, much, much harder on Hezbollah, apparently. So
maybe Israel doesn't want to shut down Hezbollah. Maybe Israel wants to go after Iran.
Well, I don't know.
In other words, your grand bargain would neutralize Syria and neutralize Hezbollah, but it wouldn't prevent Iran from developing a nuclear bomb.
No, but again, I don't think Israel is in a better position now to strike Iran. I mean, you might argue, if anything, it's the opposite.
Sure, they're in a better position. They've degraded Hezbollah.
Well, in that strictly old-fashioned military sense, yes. But remember, there's a lot of other constraints on what they can do, like how enthusiastic is the United States about it? Well, what Israel just did has complicated our situation in Iraq.
Well,
okay.
The Europeans would be a lot more enthusiastic about it now than they were 2 months ago.
What's the difference between zero enthusiasm and zero enthusiasm? I don't know, but let me finish.
No, I think aren't the Europeans supposedly terrified of Iran now because they see what, you know, havoc it's causing?
I'm not. I don't know. You tell me. I'm not aware that they're more terrified than they were.
That's the CW.
Well, anyway, apparently Don Rumsfeld was not enthusiastic about how long we let Israel go on in Lebanon, precisely because he saw how much this was complicating our situation in Iraq. Okay, so that whole situation is now more delicate.
Yeah, I was wondering why we didn't tell Olmert, look, this is not exactly the best time to strike the death blow against Hezbollah, given our precarious situation in Iraq.
Wait, why didn't we tell him that?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, leave aside our interest, why didn't we do what would have been in Israel's interest in retrospect, if you ask me, which is, stop him after a limited outburst, you know, after a day or so of outburst, which would have been much better for Israel. Because now their military has lost considerable credibility in the area. And B, as I said, certainly once Hezbollah started shooting missiles at population centers, domestic politics prevented him from stopping things on his own, whereas Bush had the capacity to step in and, A, make it look like he didn't really have any choice, he had to stop, and, B, that would have preserved the credibility of the Israeli military. So on a number of grounds, Bush should have stepped in. It was definitely, in my view, a mistake, unless he now turns around and makes big-time lemonade out of this lemon, which I'm not confident of.
Well, the one possible out which you won't like is that the ceasefire will break down, which is, in fact, according to the Jerusalem Post, what the Israeli government expects. It's not clear to me how they think it'll break down, and will it break down in an obvious enough way that the world will somehow endorse Israel resuming fighting. I very much doubt that, but that is one operative theory of why this makes sense for Israel, is that they're not through degrading Hezbollah.
Well, I can certainly see how the ceasefire could break down. It's a really delicate maneuver that has to get performed now, with Israel withdrawing as the Lebanese military, you know, comes into southern Lebanon along with some UN force. And meanwhile, it's not clear how welcoming Hezbollah is going to be of this Lebanese military, or what the exact relationship will be, to what extent Hezbollah will have influence over nominally Lebanese government force. If you want reasons to be hopeful, I think now that a lot of people apparently are returning to their homes in Lebanon, I think Hezbollah will be more reluctant to reignite hostilities, because they already caused a certain amount of havoc in Lebanon, and I don't think they want to see a whole lot more dead Shiites. And so it could conceivably work out. But I can definitely see the ceasefire breaking down, especially since Israel, the terms of the resolution implicitly give Israel the right to act in self-defense. I think not just in defense of the Israeli homeland, but in defense of Israeli troops. So
I must admit, one of the things that bothers me about this whole situation, and this is a clever transition to our next topic.
I want to say one more thing.
Okay.
So it may wind up being a more abrupt transition than you hope, but anyway, go ahead.
There's the sense that, you know, the people who say, you know, it's all, there's this Ralph Peters article in the New York Daily News, which makes two points. It's all one war against terror, i.e. Iraq and the war against Al-Qaeda are the same war. And B,
Lebanon in there too.
Yeah, you know, well, the B is that the U.S. war and the Israeli war against Muslim fundamentalism are the same war. And basically, there's the sense that we're all Israelis now, or at least the United States is like Israel, doomed, as Stanley Kurtz says, to an eternal battle against an enemy who will never quite be vanquished. And it seems to me the whole, after 9/11, one of the prime goals of American policy should have been to avoid becoming just like Israel. And there were, you know, defenders of Israel who wanted us to be just like Israel and are sort of more comfortable in that position than others. And they seem to have at least won the mind of the Bush administration, so much so that he's now declaring, you know, like Roger Simon, well, this is a war against Islamofascism, which was pretty shocking, given that right after 9/11, he was taking his pains to say we're not at war with the Muslim world, and he did not take those pains the other day.
Yeah, no, that was, in general, I would say, our strategy since 9/11 should have been to keep the clash of civilizations from becoming a self-fulfilling prophecy. But Bush has been acting almost as if it was his goal to make it a self-fulfilling prophecy. And this use of the phrase Islamic fascism...
Well, it's more that he's been dragged into it. He never would have used that phrase 3 years ago.
Actually, he apparently had used it once before. But
okay.
he had not been using it much. And it's a terrible, terrible phrase to use because you know that many Muslims, although technically he's not saying all Muslims are fascists, you know that that's the way it's going to be interpreted. I mean, given the vagaries of translation and everything, I mean, after all, well, adjectives and nouns are often put together in exactly that way, you know. If you heard somebody referring to, you know, the Zionist fascists or something, you wouldn't think they meant those Zionists who are fascists, right? You would think they were saying all Zionists are fascists. And similarly, that's the way the phrase is going to be interpreted. I mean,
well, it's also
But can we just pause and dwell on how irresponsible it is for the President of the United States to throw around a phrase that is going to significantly ratchet up the incentive of people to, like, kill Americans? I mean, that's just...
Well, I want to make a point that will make the transition, but you have this other point you want to make, so why don't you get it out so I can say what I have to say.
Okay.
What's your additional point
on Israel? Well, I can make it at any time. It's just related to Lebanon. It's just that I'm seeing some signs. There's a meme that I would like to see get some momentum. It's the virtues of tactical restraint meme, okay? In this particular case, the idea is that, you know, if Israel had done nothing in response to this provocation, it would probably be better off than it is, and would be held in much higher esteem in the world. Its military wouldn't have suffered a loss of credibility, and so on. Certainly, if it had a brief outburst and was then restrained by the United States, it would be better off. And the point is just that a lot of times, the smart thing to do is to not exact retribution, even that you're entitled morally and or legally to exact. And encouragingly, you know, I got into this a little in the dialogue with Ann Althaus, but also Caleb Carr, who actually is kind of a war on terrorism hawk generally, had a piece in the LA Times making much this point, that both Israel and the Palestinians had often failed to understand the virtues of tactical restraint. Kevin Drum drew my attention to that by linking to it and discussing it. And anyway, Kevin noted, and it's true, that it's hard to sell this meme because retribution feels natural, it feels justified. And I guess, I mean, yeah, I'd be tempted to invoke the image, you know, the French soccer player Zidane, you know, the headbutt. It's a little like that, you know. I mean, yeah, in some sense you're entitled when somebody's talking about your mother, but kind of ultimately that was just stupid. But I guess probably that's not the rhetorical magic bullet we're looking
for. It's close, though, but yeah, I agree with you, but I don't want to wallow in it. If people want to wallow in anti-Bush feeling,
that's not the point. The point is to really
look at this week with George Stephanopoulos.
It applies to a lot of contexts. I mean, first of all, I should say that if nothing else, this Zidane thing gives me an excuse to link to what I think is a kind of a funny video page where somebody did some creative things with the Zidane video, and I'll link to that. But secondly, I think, and maybe this will be our transition, the idea of tactical restraint has a lot of, it makes sense in a lot of contexts, and I think, in a way, this is a stretch of the concept, but you know, when it comes to foiled terrorist plots and things, we should kind of not overreact, even in terms of kind of the magnitude of the precautions we take after these things are uncovered.
Well, I'm willing to take magnitude of the precautions. The point I was going to make is that the whole, it's not just the war against Islamofascism, there's a question of whether we want to call it a war at all. I had always resisted this, what would be a liberal meme, which is which Matt Miller started years ago, saying we shouldn't call it a war. And Jim Fallows has a piece in The Atlantic saying, well, maybe we should have called it a war, but now we should declare victory and end it. And, you know, that's sort of a gimmick that allows him to stop calling it a war. But the problem with the war is it sort of implies that the enemy is still out there in a sort of lingering way. And, A, you know, terrorism is defined, so as long as the enemy is out there and surviving, the enemy is sort of won. And, B, it means that every, you know, Arab kid wakes up in the morning and says, there's a war on, which side should I be on? And, you know, it gives credibility to the other side because, hey, it's the whole side of a war that's preoccupying the West. Maybe they, you know, and if they only attract 1% of the population, they're in business. So it does seem to me that the statement was probably, you know, if he said we stand against Islamofascism and join the Muslim nations of the world in their struggle against it, that would be different. But it's more the war than the Islamofascism.
Well, I think
thing.
Both are highly suboptimal. I mean, I've used the phrase war a lot myself.
Well, there you go. You're part of the problem.
I am part of the problem. You see, there are two kind of
as
related
usual
questions. I mean, one is the problem of terrorism serious enough to be kind of the organizing principle of our foreign policy? And Jim Fallows thinks the answer is no. And is war the right term? And he also thinks the answer is no. But you can separate those. I think terrorism should be close to the center of our thinking about future national security because it's the most intractable threat
we
face, and
point.
Not just Muslim terrorism, but terrorism generically. But I agree that the term war seems to me increasingly counterproductive. At the same time, if any politician does what Jim is suggesting and says, oh, we won, and the next day some plot like this is uncovered, even if that doesn't technically defy the logic of Jim's argument, that politician is going to look like a complete idiot.
Well, plus, that's one flaw in Jim's argument, which I hadn't thought of. The other flaw is that he tries to argue that al-Qaeda is beaten, so he can declare victory. And clearly, al-Qaeda isn't beaten. Unless you think this latest foiling of the terror plot against these airliners represents a significant weakness on the part of al-Qaeda, which some people have argued. I think I saw a Stratfor argument to that effect. I'm not sure that's true. Do you think this, we foiled the plot, good. We don't know what other plots are out there, and does this show that, you know, they're alive and plotting, or does this show that they can't plot without us finding out about it?
Well, it's kind of encouraging on the second front, but at the same time, I think it shows that the question isn't whether al-Qaeda has been defeated. I don't think we still know whether al-Qaeda per se is related to this, right?
Right, but my point is, instead of declaring victory, we could just, like, stop talking about it. That seems the better strategy than Fallows' strategy. Fallows thinks he's coming
with declaring victory, look, you can't expect a politician to do it. Anybody who does it risks looking like an idiot the next day, and
And it's manifestly untrue. We haven't won.
Right, I think, you can argue the war's not the right term. Right, I mean, even if we've defeated al-Qaeda, one thing that this plot illustrates is how much more fluid than that the enemy actually is. I mean,
well, but that's okay. If we had defeated al-Qaeda, we could declare victory and then just shut up about it.
We could declare victory against al-Qaeda, but the fact is that that, you know, terrorism as a phenomenon,
that's different.
Well, right. But it's called the war on terror. It's not called the war on Al-Qaeda. What's worrisome about terrorism is how fluid it is, how far potentially it goes beyond Al-Qaeda. And,
Right, the goal now should be stopping the copycats, not stopping Al-Qaeda.
Well, exactly. As some of us have been saying all along, that's ultimately the bigger problem. And I think the Bush administration has been kind of slow to grasp that. And continues to want to link everything to Al-Qaeda, you know, so that it doesn't have to complicate its worldview.
Now it's leading into Islamofascism, so that's potentially broader than
Al-Qaeda. Well, it still leapt to the conclusion that the speculation that Al-Qaeda was related, whereas the British weren't doing that.
But clearly Al-Qaeda is related. You don't think this is an Al-Qaeda deal?
I don't think we know. But certainly one thing about it is it's the kind of thing that didn't have to be, right? If you wanted to just take down one plane, this is something like five guys could just decide to do. As long as one or two of them wanted to...
I actually think these liquid weapons are... Danny Benjamin seems to imply that it's quite hard to develop them technically. You got to have the liquid; it has to be stable somehow. Yet, when combined with this other thing, it
okay. Well, good. Maybe it does require more in the way of infrastructure than I thought.
You know, a lot of things that seem technically difficult now are you know easy as pie in 10 years.
So. Yeah. Can I complain briefly about the way this has worked out spin-wise for the Democrats?
Yeah, I think I'm going to agree with you again, and then we will spend half an hour agreeing. But go ahead.
In such engaging and entertaining fashion, Mickey.
Less engaging than previous.
Well, I was just disappointed by, you know, Lieberman came out, trying to, I won't use the word demagogue, but trying to exploit this rhetorically and say, oh, this just shows that Ned Lamont is, you know, hopelessly deluded because, you know, if we pull out from Iraq, this will only embolden terrorists such as this.
Right.
And that was the connection he tried to draw between Iraq and this foiled plot. And
right, but he was attacking his Iraq policy, not attacking his general attitude to the war on terror.
Well,
he is vulnerable on Iraq.
Let me tell you what Lamont said in response.
We haven't gotten
to my complaint yet.
Okay, well, I'm trying to,
trying to speed the thing along.
I'm trying to interrupt these long harangues with little nasty point.
Okay, what's the nasty point?
No, the nasty point is Lamont is vulnerable on Iraq because he does want to pull out, and that would be a disaster. So it seems to me Lieberman's entitled to make that point.
Well, wait. It would clearly be a disaster to pull out?
Yes. In previous dialogues, you have said we should not pull out precipitously. You said that. Maybe you're changing your position to the Peter Galbraith retreat to the Kurdish stronghold position, and you're allowed to do that. But that has not been your position.
Well, first of all, it has not been
Lamont's position. You've been saying that Lamont's position was irresponsible, as it is.
No. First of all, I've been saying I was not yet convinced that it made sense to withdraw. Secondly, the frame of analysis has been totally what the implications for Iraq. I just said it's not clear to me that chaos won't ensue. Lieberman is saying something else here. He's saying that it will be seen as a sign of retreat and will embolden these kinds of people. Now, that's one arguable effect, but there's a whole other side of the equation in the Iraq War, which is that the Iraq War has clearly increased the number of young males around the world who are willing to commit suicide to harm Americans, okay?
Well, that's what Lamont should have said in response.
Exactly. That's what the whole liberal blogosphere should have said, and it was disturbingly slow to figure it out.
That's what they all said on Chris Matthews on Saturday.
Finally, after 48 hours or whatever have gone by. I mean, look, when the New York Times calls Lamont and gives him Lieberman's remarks, the paraphrasal is, Lamont questioned whether the war in Iraq had any bearing on terrorist designs on Western nations. No, it does have a bearing. It should be talking point number one for you. The Iraq War has increased the number of terrorists against America. And that should be like an instinct for him at this point. He finally later issued a statement, illustrating that he could make this point.
Well, they're done in by the paranoia of the Bush administration. Harry Reid was, too. Harry Reid's statement was, well, there goes Bush playing politics again. Well, if Bush was right, he'd be perfectly justified to play politics with it.
I did a Technorati search, and that's what almost all the liberal blogs were saying at first. You know, what a despicable exploitation. No, they should have turned it around immediately and said, I can't believe Lieberman has the gall to bring up Iraq in this context.
Well, that's because they're so locked into their hyper-partisanship that the first thing they look for is the Cheney conspiracy. Did he know about, you know, did he know about the impending roll-up of the terror plot when he criticized Lamont on Wednesday? Did he know what was going to happen Thursday? Instead of dealing with the substance, it's all these partisan tactics.
Well, anyway, I'll tell you, so slow afoot was the left-wing blogosphere that I finally read this point in the MSM in a Paul Krugman column. My Technorati search did yield our own David Korn making this point, parenthetically, in a fairly early blog post, but it was really disappointing. I mean, you know, I don't know. Do you think I should be put in charge of the Democrats' talking points on the war on terror, Mickey?
Maybe you should run for office from whatever undisclosed location you're broadcasting from.
Well, as you know, I haven't ruled out the possibility of accepting
you
the draft.
You and Ann Coulter are the only two people I know who want to keep their locations secret.
No, go ahead. I'm in my study.
Okay. Well, there you go. And it's a little fishy that never mind.
Mickey?
Yeah, okay. I think we're through with the terror.
But I'm so curious as to what you were about to say.
Well, maybe you're in the same place, you know, if you're both in secret locations.
Oh, me and?
Yeah.
No.
You protest too much.
Alas, that's just your hyperactively jealous mind playing tricks on you.
Could be. I agree. The thing is, not only does it help them recruit, it helps them recruit a better quality of recruits. So, you know, if more... You know, university engineering students are outraged by our invasion of Iraq and want to join al-Qaeda. That's maybe more damaging to us than if a bunch of uneducated farmers are motivated to join al-Qaeda.
Yeah, no, I mean, I am really disturbed, seriously disturbed, that more people on the left didn't leap on this as soon as Lieberman said
that. Well, Chris Matthews a day, that was pretty fast. I mean, they tape on Friday, and they all said it. It was like... a completely boring show because they had four MSM reporters, all of whom were making your point.
Matthews tapes on Friday?
I assume so. Why wouldn't he tape on Friday?
I think all these guys tape later than they used to because of the blogosphere. But, you know, that reminds me. Another thing is I really think the partisan left-wing blogosphere is too hard on Chris Matthews. His foreign policy is right-minded, and he has all the more credibility by virtue of the fact that he's not kind of totally predictably left, and I mean, I don't quite understand how he became one of their bête noirs. I mean, I'm not imagining this. He kind of did, right?
Impeachment. He was very anti-Clinton during impeachment.
I see.
He didn't want to move on.
So it all goes back to that.
Can I move to our life entertainment-related topic?
Yeah, as I understand it, you want to do a review of Oliver Stone's movie without having seen the movie?
No, I just want to say why I'm happy. It's not doing too well. Paramount is desperately spinning to try to imply that, well, the word of mouth is still good. But it did badly before the terror attacks, and the terror attacks sort of hurt it even more.
Really?
It's done $25, $26 million worth of business, which isn't bad. But it's not huge. It got $65 million to make. It's certainly not it's not what they expected. They expected to do much better. And I just wanted to explain why I'm happy that it's doing badly. First, it was irresponsible to assign Oliver Stone to do this movie, even if he turns out not to have produced a, conspiratorial left-wing
diatribe. Now, that's a surprise, right? It's not a left-wing movie?
It's not a left-wing movie, but it's sort of an anodyne nothing movie, apparently. It's just a sort of hack drama. But the second point is, there was a very, very gripping story that was worthy of a movie in itself, which is the story of this patriotic religious Marine who was a stockbroker and, drove down from Connecticut and was the guy who while all the uniformed professional rescuers are told to stay off the burning pile, he's brave or crazy, however you want to put it, enough to walk out on the burning pile. And he's the guy who found these two guys. And Stone apparently portrays him as a little bit of a religious maniac, which you'd sort of have to be as brave as he was. And he slights the story because the story that Paramount bought was the story of these two cops who basically just sit under the rubble for hours and hours waiting for this Marine to rescue.
Yeah, anybody can do that, right?
Well, it's just not as dramatically gripping. And they don't like this Marine. He was a vigilante. He wasn't a uniformed cop. He showed up the uniformed cops. The uniformed cops are embarrassed that this civilian does their job better than they did, and so they're not going to expand his role. And Rebecca Liss, who reported on this Marine story, points out that they completely slighted the role of this medic, who was incredibly heroic in rescuing these guys, and like the walls were going to cave in on him, and he held them open with his arms, and it was, he propped things up so they could reach in the jaws of life, and he really risked everything, and he's not shown as being the first guy to go into the hole in the film. They fictionalize and downplay his role. Her point is that he's made it a much dull, because they bought into the story of these two cops. They made it a much duller story than it could have been. It could have been a great tale of patriotism and redemption, because this medic was a defrocked medic. He couldn't practice anymore, and the crisis let him put on his uniform and go down and do great things.
So why would it be better if they had this? It would have been a better story, or
it's a better story. It's an ordinary citizen taking action in this incredible event.
And what's the theory about why the studio didn't want it in? What's wrong with that?
Because they bought the story of the cops, and the cops don't like the Marine. So the Marine's role gets squeezed down into a little bitty role.
They bought the story? They paid for the rights to the story?
Yeah.
That doesn't mean they have to respect the cops' wishes. They bought the story. They can,
They bought a screenplay from a woman who was, doing it as told by the cops.
Yeah, so studios are famous for the respect they pay to the screenplays they buy,
well,
right?
Because they picked a crazy guy like Oliver Stone, they had to order him to stick to the script. And the script was told POV cops.
I don't know. This sounds like you have a conspiracy theory about an Oliver Stone movie, which is an interesting thing in its own right.
Well, that's why Oliver Stone is so conspiratorial, because he works in Hollywood where everything is a conspiracy.
Yeah.
But anyway, I'm happy if it fails.
I'm always happy if he fails. I mean, my complaint about him, here's a riddle. What do Oliver Stone and George Bush have in common?
They both have something to do with Woody Harrelson.
No, they both have Monocaean views of the world. They both view the world in terms of good and evil. I hate that, whether it's on the left or the right. It's not good for the world. If you look at an Oliver Stone movie, whether Platoon or Wall Street or whatever, there's these good guys and these evil guys. I don't like that.
Interesting.
That's not the way the world is.
Well, wasn't Natural Born Killers subtle and nuanced?
Yes.
I mean, they were evil guys.
The media is responsible for all violence in the world. That was really subtle.
And you of course know what the unsubtle connection between Natural Born Killers and the Lamont Lieberman campaign is.
I do not.
Jane Hampshire, the Fire Dog Lake blogger who got Lamont into trouble by running a picture of Joe Lieberman in blackface, was the producer of Natural Born Killers.
Wow.
And apparently wrote a very good book about it. It was a famously decadent and drug-addled set. And she apparently tells all in her book.
Does she?
Yes, I don't know whether she ultimately disowns the picture or not. She's a very smart lady.
Yeah, well, it's a good blog. But we should have her on.
That'd be great. If she'd do it.
You assume there's anyone who wouldn't do Blogging Heads TV, Mickey?
No. I have to fend off the people, too. So.
Mm.
Okay, well, anyway. Neither of us likes Oliver Stone.
Nope.
What about the threat of Kausism? You said you read Kevin Drum's blog before, but I know you were just reading it by accident when you were really looking for his attacks on me.
Well, it certainly was the tastiest thing I came across while I was looking at it, I'll say that. And you emailed me about this thing that someone said about us well down into the comments section in this blog item that Kevin wrote about you, which we'll get to. But
yeah, I don't have a lot of fans in Kevin's
comments
section.
It amazed me that you could get down that far into the comment section, because when I was reading that, before you had emailed me, I was thinking, man, if I was Mickey, I mean, this was just Mickey hater after Mickey hater. I said, if I was Mickey, I don't think I could get four or five entries into this comment section without dialing 911 or at least, like, bailing out completely. I mean, that was, woo, you got some people who don't like you.
You develop a thick skin in the blogging
world,
Bob.
You have thick skin, I'll give you that. And I don't, and congratulations. But, whoa, do they not like you?
Well, their basic point, and this is the substantive point is, and you know, this was, Paul Krugman made this point, you know, years ago, is that, you know, we neoliberals are a bunch of old fogies who were still fighting the wars of the Carter era and the Mondale era and thinking that liberal special interest groups are the problem and the problems of liberalism are the problem, when really the Republicans are so evil that the only moral thing to do is wage an all-out, solidaristic, partisan, vicious, nasty war against Bush and his evil cronies. And I don't, you know, I don't think that's a crazy view. It just happens not to be my view for a bunch of reasons. One, the main reason is it's an Iraq problem. What do the Democrats do? You know, it's one thing to demonize Saddam Hussein and throw him from power. What do you do when you've won? What are the Democrats who've demonized Bush going to do when they throw him from power? Answer, they're going to screw up again just like Jimmy Carter, and then they'll be out of power again soon. So it seems to me it is the better course to guard against that, and that's what I try to do, you know. Anyway.
You're the military police in your metaphor.
I especially
in
said...
In this war against the Republicans, you're the military police.
No, I said in my dialogue with... by a vlog with Josh that I could say that, but I admit that I take too much relish in it to I'm not a...
Well, here's the thing. I mean, the argument...
To be a military policeman.
The argument you just attributed to them is not the argument that Kevin made in the post I saw. I mean...
Kevin made the argument is, where are all the anti-Bush posts? Why? You have 80% anti-Democratic posts, 20% anti-Bush posts. Why don't you, like, generate some really boring anti-Bush posts that are the same as the ones everybody else says, and then you'll convince us you're anti-Bush.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, here's the thing about you, is just the frustrating thing about you is this claim that ultimately your sympathies are with the Democratic Party just kind of rings hollow. And we had some heated exchanges during the last presidential election because you claimed you were for Kerry, yet you devoted all your blogging time to reducing his chances of winning. And when I asked you about that, you know, I said, look, Mickey, clearly, emotionally, you're not for Kerry. You kind of acknowledged it, and you entered a plea of, like, poor impulse control or something. I mean,
I see the role of being a if I were running for office or even if I was on Blogging Heads TV, I would try to present a fair and balanced assessment of my views. When I'm a blogger, I try to say what I think. The whole virtue of blogging is that you're getting the unfiltered what people think. I don't try to say what is solidaristic with my fellows in the Democratic coalition. And second, I try to say things where I have something to add to the conversation. I try not to bore people. I try not to write things that I wouldn't want to read, where I say the same thing everybody else says about how President Bush is encouraging more terrorists.
Fine, but if I
have said that. I say that once every 6 months, and you know, so what?
Okay, but if I could try to add a third item to your list, I mean, if you're a blogger, I don't see how you can get up in the morning, every morning, and keep blogging if there isn't this third goal of, on balance, influencing the world in what you consider to be a kind of good direction by your lights. So if it's true that you've come to the conclusion that it's better for Kerry to win this election than for Bush to win this election, and yet you spend pretty much all your blogging time trying to make it more likely that Bush will win, I really just don't get that. I really don't. And I told you at the time, and I still don't.
I wrote a ringing endorsement of Kerry.
Yeah, you wrote one endorsement whose sincerity was called into question by everything else you said.
No, its sincerity was enhanced by the fact that I clearly wasn't a Kerry shell. And I wrote it a week before the election, which is when you write things that you want to influence the election. 6 months out, I said what I thought about Kerry, which turned out to be completely true. You're arguing one should suppress the truth that Kerry is a dork.
No, you can say it once, but it wasn't just what you said, Mickey.
What can one say about Kerry's flaws? According to you, one can say nothing, because every little thing you say is going to help Bush.
No, you say it once, but when you're getting up day after day and deciding what to write, you call attention to the things that you think will increase the chances of your candidates winning. I mean...
Well, until the end of the convention, I actually held out hope that Kerry wouldn't get the nomination.
It wasn't just that, Mickey. Go back and review your post, because we had this argument, and you conceded the point. You have conceded in conversation to me the point that, yes, the upshot of your blog was to help Bush during the run-up to the election. Because then you got into this thing about how, yes, rationally I want Kerry to win, but, you know, emotionally, granted, and I didn't follow the rest of the argument. But you didn't used to deny that you were helping Bush
de facto. Go put a ding-a-ling to the moment when you think I admitted.
No, we weren't on tape, Mickey. This was back before Blogging Heads. This was during the run-up.
Oh, so there's no record of this?
No, there's no record. I'm just saying it happened.
So it's your word against mine.
That's correct.
I don't recall this moment. But
I do.
Look, yes, I have an idea of blogging where I don't spend a whole lot of time try to say what I think is true. And I try to say what's interesting. I don't spend a whole lot of time calculating, will this help or hurt the political causes that I like. I used to do that all the time. For some reason, I can't do that anymore. When I was working in Newsweek, yes. I mean, I wrote all sorts of things that were designed to help elect Dukakis over Bush, which would have been a good thing. But I just can't do that anymore. I don't know why. It seems fundamentally enervating to get up in the morning and say, okay, now I'm going to lie to help my political causes.
No, it's not lying we're talking about, Mickey. It's you're choosing which item to write. You get up every day, Bush has said something stupid, Kerry has said something stupid. Which do you write?
And there are 100
I'm not
bloggers,
asking you to be dishonest.
And there are 100 bloggers saying that Bush has said something stupid, and nobody's saying that Kerry said something stupid.
No,
I say,
Mickey, there are 100 bloggers on the right saying that about Kerry. And it just so happens they're the group you identify with.
What I can add to this conversation is pointing out that Kerry has said something stupid. I'm not writing in isolation.
You're adding nothing. You're just an echo of Instapundit. You're not adding anything, Mickey.
I don't have the Andrew Sullivan fallacy where I think I am responsible for giving a view of punditizing on everything. I know my place in the blog ecosystem, which is I'm the guy that snipes at Democrats while there are 100 people who defend Democrats. Fine. If I were the only blogger in the world, I would write it differently.
Mickey, there's 100 bloggers trashing Democrats every day. You think you're rendered unique by the fact that you claim you're actually a Democrat and you're doing it. Well, isn't that eccentric? Yeah, it's eccentric, and there's a reason it doesn't happen more often. It's incoherent.
It's not incoherent. Why are the only two choices in the world to be a Democrat or a Republican? I went down the list of things that the Democrats do that I really don't like. And some of them they've come around on, but a lot of them they haven't. They're pro-giving cash welfare to people. Well, they've pretty much come around on that, not completely. They're pro-redistribution, which I think is sort of futile, but makes sense at the bottom, so I, you know, give them a pass on that. They're pro-affirmative action, which I think is a bad thing that divides Americans. They're not going to give up on that. In fact, they're so vindictive about it that even though Joe Lieberman kowtowed to them on that, Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton showed up to get their revenge many years later in Connecticut. They're for supporting the teachers' unions as they help destroy the public schools. That's a bad thing. Their policies tend to degenerate into slush funds for Democratic mayors. That's a bad thing. And they've added the point of this... immigration reform that's going to lower wages at the bottom, make the poor poorer, and threaten to split America apart. So am I supposed to say, hey, I really like those things because the Democrats are for them?
No.
No. So why is it incoherent?
No, again, it's all in what you choose to spend your time blogging about. And let me say that...
Well, all you care about is Iraq, Bob. You want to spend every blogging heads talking about Iraq.
Well, yeah, but I'm not sitting here claiming that I'm actually a Bush supporter while I diss Bush's Iraq strategy and his war on terror strategy. I mean, I'm my identity seems to me pretty coherent. I say I'm against Bush. I talk like it.
It's coherent in that sense, but you're being very highly selective in the issues you care about.
Well,
and
I'm
when
not.
The Democrats get into power, it's going to be a disaster because you haven't addressed any of the problems of progressivism, whatever the hell that is.
Hey, progressive realism, buddy.
Okay, sorry.
Careful.
Well,
that's a delicate meme.
The point is, and this is actually a good point to segue into our last topic. Not causism, but cosism. I had underestimated the extent to which the philosophy of De Lee Coase and his cohorts in MoveOn, like Eli Pariser, is a real phenomenon. They call themselves progressives, but what the heck does that mean? There are a number of sort of principles of this. One is, which I had underestimated, which Noam Scheib wrote a very good piece about, is they claim to hate the special interests of the Democratic Party in favor of some larger vision of progressivism.
Do they claim to hate the special interests or to...
Coase has a good chapter in his book where he attacks the special interests. Now, my point is, he attacks them not because he disagrees with them, but because they're so monomaniacal in pursuing their own little interests that they're ineffective at pursuing those interests. We would get better environmental protection if environmentalists weren't such a single interest group. That's his point. Progressivism over special interests, partisanship. You know, some bloggers said partisanship is the new black. Lieberman isn't partisan enough. We need a strong partisan thrust against the Republicans, against Clintonian triangulation. That's the second principle. And the third principle is probably, I would say, partisanship over any sort of self-criticism. That's the point that you were just making. That's sort of coherent, but it all depends on there being a viable philosophy and set of policies to go in this unspecified bin marked progressivism. And aside from health care and raising the minimum wage, I just don't really see it. Unless it's the same old interest group demands that were there before.
So you're saying it's not clear that say, Coase has a real agenda, policy-wise?
Well, that's certainly true. And they've hit on this partisanship as a way to obviate what I would say is the necessary policy critique, where you may end up saying the Democrats are wrong on something.
Yeah, well, I mean, I want to clarify. I'm not complaining about your doing that, and you've been very effective in doing that.
In order to justify doing that, I have to spend five times as much time writing what everybody else says against Bush.
No.
That would make you happy.
No, I mean, well, first of all, The things you are saying in critique of the Democrats are things other people are saying. It's just that they're people who are calling themselves Republicans. So, I mean, I'm not saying you've never been original.
That's,
in fact, wait, let me say a couple of nice things
true.
About you, Mickey.
That's not necessarily true.
What?
That's just not necessarily true. People aren't saying we need to cut Social Security so we can make way for national health care. That's not a Republican position.
Well, I'm sure you're not the only person in the universe calling attention to that fiscal trade-off. But let me
there are a lot of people in the center of the Democratic Party. I agree, but the left hates them too.
Well,
and they make exactly the same critique against Fromm and Bruce Reed. There's nobody who they hate more than Al Fromm.
Yeah. Well, let me say first of all, in your dialogue with Josh Marshall last week, I thought you held your own in arguing that there are these kinds of issues that need attention and that you're calling attention to. That's not my criticism. And, you know, I'm a big fan of your book, The End of Equality, and I supported you on welfare reform we both supported it or something. You're the one who called my attention to the whole argument and made the first compelling argument I ever read in the New Republic long time before it finally happened.
So get to the ship.
And also, I just think you're a wonderful human being and have a tremendous fashion sense. But
yeah, okay. It's on display today.
What I'm complaining about, and my complaint specifically relates to the election when you just drove me nuts. Why dwell on this? I'm just saying, if you really in your heart believe that one candidate is better than the other, I don't see how you can spend almost all your time trying to increase the chances that the bad candidate wins. And that's what I think you were doing by any reasonable estimation, during the election?
I was saying Kerry was a turkey, and if you were a good Democrat, it would have been a whole lot better if you'd spend more time listening to people who said Kerry was a turkey, because he was a turkey and he lost the election.
That was all true and relevant up to the point when he got the nomination, but you didn't stop then.
Well, there's a two-month period in the summer doldrums before the election took in where you could argue that I didn't stop criticizing, but I did sort of gradually stop, and I came around a week.
I beg to differ. We'll let readers decide.
I came around a week before the election. I'm a loyal Democrat. I'm a foot soldier.
that sounded like a pretty half-hearted proclamation. Anyway, this Noam Scheiber thing, is that...
I just thought it was interesting because it crystallized the sense in which, on the national level, the Democratic interest groups are passé and are being overwhelmed by this generalized force for progressivism of the partisan net roots. And it also pointed out that might be a good thing because, you know, people who believe in an ideology as opposed to special interests could get a lot done. And to the extent to which, you know, people like me have always been whining about, oh, the special interests control the Democratic Party, well, now they don't. And if we don't like what's happening, we better come up with another critique. And I thought it was, I hadn't grasped the full force of that. In fact, I had written something that was not true, where I said that Coase didn't critique the special interests.
So you and Coase have something in common. I'm trying to build bridges here, Mickey.
No, Coase wrote a post which we've talked about before, where he sort of implied that maybe he's against affirmative action. I mean, there's tremendous potential for Coase to go to the right, and there's tremendous potential for, you know, Coase's cadres, all these Netroots troops, to be led around by the nose in some completely new direction. They have no loyalty to the unions, for example. They do have loyalty to low-wage workers, which is fine. But people say, Mickey, why are you criticizing them? They're like a million troops out there ready to be led by somebody, and maybe they'll be led in a good direction. There's a certain amount of truth to that.
Although, the more you refer to them as being led by the nose, the less likely it seems to me you're going to be the person to win their allegiance ultimately.
I think I've probably...
You may have already blown that chance.
I think I've blown that opportunity.
Yeah. I didn't get the end of the... I'm not sure I understand the very end of the Scheiber piece where he says, the problem is that you take a Harry Reid who's turned out to play this atmosphere very ably, right? He plays the, what does he call it, counter-Bushism is the reigning ideology in the Netroots.
Right.
And he
right.
says he does that very well, but in this, what was it he said, but in the future, how will someone like a Harry Reid come up through the ranks? How will he win in local elections without being a special interest partisan or something? What was it? Was that it?
Well, I agree it doesn't make any sense. I mean, you wouldn't get Harry Reid, but you'll get some other people who rise up through the ranks through the Netroots.
Although, he may have an argument there. If he's saying that the problem is that special interests will remain important at the local level, so the criteria for rising through the ranks as a politician, as a Democratic politician, will be different for the criteria for successful performance once you're a national politician. So the people who rise up to a certain level...
That's a very good point, and that is definitely true, because at the local level, the special interests aren't dead at all. If you look at California politics, it's controlled by the teachers' union.
I think that was his point, and it was kind of a compressed way of conveying...
That's a very good point. I thought his point was that there are politicians like Reid who can get elected from red states or purple states because they champion one special interest plank, and that allows them to be progressive on nine others, and those people won't get elected. And if you ran on a straight progressive platform and screw the special interest, maybe you wouldn't be a senator from Nevada. So I thought that was his point.
Yeah.
But the local point is that that's a very good point. It's, you know, California Democrats, look at who they've generated in their run for governor. It's Phil Angelides, a guy who's carried the water for the teachers' unions. He's going to get shellacked. Even at the California level, he'd have no chance at a national level, a politician like that. I mean, he's not Bill Clinton.
I think that was the argument, yeah.
Yeah, well, that's a very good argument. And the local-national split is very important here. The special interests may be dead nationally, but they ain't dead locally. Once again, you've pierced through the fog.
I feel bad about yelling at you earlier, Mickey.
What was it that Kevin Drum commentator said about you?
Oh, the one who said that... What, that watching me and you debate was like watching Helen Thomas play Dwayne Wade in one-on-one or something?
Yes, yeah, I believe that was.
Except, I think you were Helen Thomas, right?
I think I was Helen
yeah.
Thomas, yes.
Although, you know, she can jump.
I hear she has a mean hook shot.
She can. She used to be able to dunk. A lot of people don't know that about Helen Thomas. Do you know a guy named Tom O'Gorman, Mickey?
No.
Because I waited down in those... It was in the Mark Kleiman post about you, actually. You should get to know him. He was like your one major advocate, and he had the goods. He's been following you. He's a fan. Tom O'Gorman. Send him an email.
Great.
Can I close asking you about Mark Kleiman's little metaphor here? When people claim you don't love the Democratic Party, he writes, but I'm not that cynical. I think Mickey genuinely loves the Democratic Party, just as many an abusive husband dearly loves his wife. The bruises and broken bones, however, remain. Now, I know you're going to dismiss that, but Mickey, I think there could conceivably be something to that metaphor, which is that some abusive husbands, they hit their wives in moments of jealousy. So in other words, they're insecure about the wife's affection for them. And I'm just delving into your psychopathology, or let's just in more neutral terms, delving into your psychological history. Is there any chance that in the 80s, when you pioneeringly started noting these problems with reigning Democratic ideology, and it really was important stuff, that you felt spurned by the Democratic Party, and were seen...
Not at all, because back then neolibs were the new black. Neolibs were in. People bought you drinks at bars because you were a neolib.
Okay.
So no.
So you
didn't feel spurned at all. It's only now that I feel spurned. I would claim that Mark is, you know... Mark is overstating my love for the Democratic Party. I want national health care. I want to raise the minimum wage. I want people of all incomes to be able to live a life of dignity. If the Democratic Party can't achieve that, screw them.
Okay. So
Mark is wrong, and Mark is much too nice. He says, you know, some of what the teachers' unions want is too much. Well, that's not the problem. The problem is that the core thing they want, which is they don't want you to be able to fire their incompetent members, is at the core of why education reform won't work unless they're beaten. And until you point that out rather forcefully, you ain't going to win.
Well, I don't know enough about teachers' unions to argue with you right now. We're running out of time anyway. But
okay.
You deem that last success to get at the roots of what I call your psychopathology as having been unsuccessful then?
Almost any theory that relies on my sexual insecurity will be right, except that one.
Well, no, the problem with it is that it wasn't insecurity per se. That was merely a metaphor for
it. Was an analogy. Okay, well, maybe that's the problem.
That is the problem.
Next week you should go for the real
thing. So next week we will talk about your sex life per se.
But that's not true. You said I was spurned as a neolib in the 70s.
What?
So you said I was spurned as a neolib in the 70s, so that played on personal insecurities, and that's just not true.
Well, I don't think he said that. I was reading this into his metaphor.
Right.
I was trying to turn his metaphor into a whole theory.
No, I know. But it didn't work.
It didn't work, so we will. So next time we'll get into your sex life.
No.
No. Okay.
Okay.
Whatever.
Only when you reveal your undisclosed location.
I'm in my study.
Okay.
It's no secret. See you around.
See ya. Bye.